On today's show, we're letting out our inner train otaku with a fascinating discussion about the history of the Yamanote Line. Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast, brought to you by Jobs in Japan. If you're looking for a new job in Japan or you're looking to change jobs, head over to Jobs in Japan and check out the work opportunities that they have there. Conveniently named jobsinjapan.com. I wonder who thought of that. But anyways, on today's show, I'm going to be talking with Michael Firewood, who runs a YouTube channel called Japan History, where he documents the history of the Japanese rail system. And I got to tell you, you know, like I'm kind of harsh on Japan a lot of times on this show. And I told you, I just know that, you know, but the Japanese rail system and the Japanese transportation system are just hands down the best in the world. I have never visited another country where their rail system or their public mass transit system was better than Japan. That country might exist. If you know that country, let me know. I'd actually like to visit it. I like to see a country that does it better than Japan because I've yet to find anyone. And the cool thing about it is you can go to like the middle of Inaka nowhere in Japan, catch a bus, catch a taxi or whatever, and it's still fantastic. Like however many thousands of meetings that they had to have had to create that system. I mean, hats off to those Satos who sat through all that meeting because it's fantastic. And Michael, he's a bit of a train otaku, so he runs his YouTube channel called Japan History, where he analyzes kind of the history of different train lines. And it's really fascinating, actually. And, you know, one of the things I really find fascinating about the rail system in Japan is just the sheer numbers, the statistics of it. Like, for example, did you know that, you know, the Yamanote Line? Everybody knows the Yamanote Line is the green line that runs around the city. The Yamanote Line has a daily ridership of about 3 to 5 million passengers. Then they may sound like a lot, like, wow, 3 to 5 million passengers per day. But when it comes to congestion on the train, the Yamanote Line doesn't even crack the top 10 in Tokyo. That honor goes to the Tozai Line, which has a congestion rate of 199%. Isn't that crazy? And the funny thing is, the Japanese government official documents classify 200% congestion rate as like uncomfortable. That's like okay, well, that's too much. We got to add like another train, another carriage or something like that. But 199%, that's like daijoubu. You know, you're at the giddy point. But as long as we can push a few more salary men into there, then you're all good. But the Tozai Line sits at 199%, while the Yamanote Line sits at a spacious 100%. And so, you know, and during rush hour, I know some, you know, it doesn't feel very spacious at all. You're like, what? This, you know, it could be more crowded. But yeah, don't ever underestimate the ability of the Japanese to cram onto the train, even when there's absolutely no space. So on today's show, we're actually going to be talking about the Yamanote Line specifically and the history of the Yamanote Line and how that all came about. And what's really interesting is, you know, the original idea for the Yamanote Line wasn't even to move people, but it was actually to move cargo.
It was all born out of freight distribution throughout Japan. Passenger movement and flow wasn't even considered back in 1872 when the first official train line opened between Shimbashi and Yokohama. That 29-kilometer stretch of train track was ultimately the first bit of Yamanote Line, that section between Shinagawa and Shimbashi. It was 3 kilometers, and that's the section that was built on the stone embankment off Tokyo Bay today. And ultimately land reclamation activities over the last 150 years, that bay has been progressively filled in. And now Shinagawa, how it's where it hasn't moved, but it is now 1.5 kilometers from the shoreline of that bay today. Ultimately, the second section of line was the Tohoku line from the north of Japan. So there was a lot of distribution of freight up there. There was a lot of silk manufacturing going on in the Gunma Prefecture, a lot of vegetables being grown in the north, and that was all getting ferried down via cargo train services, and they would terminate at Ueno. And that's where the train line would stop at the north there. And Ueno Station itself ultimately became known as the northern gateway to Japan. So if you wanted to go north, you'd travel to Ueno, you'd hop on at the terminal there, and head north. But there was a missing link in all of this, and that was a 5.5 kilometer section from Weno in the north to Shinagawa in the south. But it turns out that in between that 5.5 kilometer section, 1 million people lived back in 1872. So it was a massive undertaking to basically connect the north and south of Tokyo. So what a private rail company ultimately done, Nippon Railways, they were called, they end up building a 20-kilometer section of line from Akabane up in the north of Tokyo along the western outskirts of Tokyo, and then connected that single line back into Shinagawa in the south, bypassing the densely populated 1 million people section in the middle. So that is ultimately how places like Shibuya and Shinjuku was born. Back then, when that train line opened in 1885, those places were basically just villages and some farmland, and they just had freight services going past every hour, taking goods in the form of rice bales and silk down south, so they could ultimately get it down to the port city of Yokohama and then distribute them throughout Japan and across the rest of Asia from there.
Yeah, I found it interesting in your video. You talked about kind of the early days of the Shinjuku station.
Yes.
I can't remember the exact number that you quoted. Do you remember the number that, like you said, like how many people go through that station every day when it first opened?
It was amazing. It blew my mind, that statistic. It was ultimately only 50 passengers used Shinjuku each day back in 1885.
Yeah.
Went
50.
Only 50. That is over 3 million today. Shinjuku is now the world's busiest station all those years later. But yeah, in the first few years of operation, only 50 people used Shinjuku back then.
Yeah, if you ever lived in Tokyo, I mean, you can't even imagine it. 3.5 million people per day go through Shinjuku Station. It has over 200 exits. The place is a nightmare. So it's just, I can't even imagine just only 50 people.
Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, I got lost in there in Shinjuku once for an hour trying to find the Shinjuku Sanchome line once. And it's just like, wow, only 50 used this back when it first opened. It's crazy.
Yeah, I got lost in there once too. I remember I put my laptop briefcase in a locker because I was going to go meet some friends for a drink. And when I came back, I couldn't remember where the locker was. I had to walk around trying to find the locker, and I just gave up. And I went to the information booth and I showed them the key and I said, hey, do you know where this locker is? And of course they knew, you know, and they're like, yeah, down over there. You know, like, yeah, it's just a phenomenally huge station.
Yeah, it's massive. And whenever I use those locker systems there, I take a photograph of the general area so I can recognize it when I return back there later in the day.
Yeah, it's unbelievable to think that like 50 people, that's just amazing, you know?
Yeah, it's astounding. I mean, you go there today and it's so jam-packed, and it's just a hustle and a bustle of people moving at all hours of the day and night, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
Back then, they were lucky to get over 100 people in the first 5 years of operation. So times have changed. And it really didn't change until after the 1923 earthquake. All the Western Line stations remained pretty much villages until the eastern half of Tokyo was pretty much destroyed and burnt down by earthquake. And after that, Tokyo seen a massive migration to the western suburbs of Tokyo. And that's when places like Shinjuku and Shibuya ultimately grew into the big town centers and cities that we know them today.
Oh, interesting. So in 1923, how much of the line was finished? Like relative to what we know it as today?
Yeah, ultimately most of the line was finished, but there was 2.5 kilometers that was still unfinished in 1923, and that was the section between Kanda and Weno Station there. They still hadn't bridged that part out, and ultimately that wouldn't get bridged out until 1925 when they finished the last elevated section. And when that opened in November 1925, Akihabara and Okachimachi were the last two stations on the loop back then to open up.
Wow, so interesting. So from 1872 to 1925 is how long it took them to complete the full circle.
Correct, that's right. So full circle was completed by 1925, And there's only been another two stations open up since 1925, and that's been Nishinopori and the Takanawa Gateway, which opened in 2020.
And how did the war affect the train line, the World War II? Was it bombed by the Americans at all, or did it survive, or what?
Yeah, the Yamanote line was devastated quite significantly during 1945. Over half the train stations were damaged in some way or another, some more so than others. You look at Tokyo Station, which is ultimately the jewel in the Yamanote line's crown, that suffered multiple direct hits by bombs, and the Marunouchi side building that we all know and love ultimately got destroyed by fire, and the steel superstructure managed to survive and the brickwork. But the restoration activities from 1946 to rebuild it, they didn't build it to the original specification. They end up cutting the third floor of that building off, and the nice copper-plated octagonal domes in the north and south ticket halls were simplified into sort of hexagonal sort of pyramid triangles made of slate instead. And the train line continued to operate. It was out of action for several days here and there, but for the most part, repair work was undertaken quite quickly, and the service continued as best as they possibly could back then. But yeah, ultimately, about half the train stations were damaged by fire and bombs. I mean, we all know, I'm pretty sure we all know that Harajuku, the wooden Harajuku station there, which ultimately has been demolished last year in 2020, it suffered a direct hit back in 1945. But fortunately, that bomb turned out to be a dud and it didn't explode. So the station ultimately got to live on till it was demolished last year.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah, I remember seeing that. Well, I was in Japan when they opened the new station at the Harajuku there. And, the new station looks nice and new.
Mm.
But I think the old one kind of had a bit more character.
Oh, yeah, agree 100% with you. Ultimately, yeah, the new station was needed. Harajuku has become a very popular tourist destination there. I wished that somehow they could find a way to have kept the old wooden station, whether, you know, in the form of a museum or a coffee shop or something like that.
But it would have been
nice to keep it.
It had kind of a if you haven't seen it, it has kind of like a old kind of a German look to it, didn't it? Like those
that's right. It was like a Northern European style of architecture, ultimately made
right,
of wood,
yeah.
And a weathercock at the top to predict the direction of wind and so forth. It was quite unique for Japanese character.
Yeah. It's for that station and Ueno Station, I always kind of felt were a little bit interesting. If you have never been inside Ueno Station, the inside of Ueno Station kind of always reminded me of those European train stations with the high ceilings, the murals, you know, kind of on the walls. And I kind of like it. You know, I remember talking to a friend of mine about kind of different train stations because we're both nerds that way. And I said to him, I said, you know, I think train stations are a really good indicator of a culture of a country and of a city. Because in Japan, the train stations are very efficient. They're very clean. They work really well, but they're not really that exciting. You know, they're just clean, tiled places. Not a lot of character, not a lot of design or anything like that.
Yeah,
you go to Munich, you go to Sweden, they got these fantastic train stations done by artists, and I think that really kind of shows kind of the personality. So these few stations in Japan that had some personality, I kind of enjoyed seeing them.
Yes, I mean, back when they built Tokyo Station, for example, in 1914 that opened, but it started construction back in 1905, and when the government wanted a design to be made for a new central station, they turned to a European architect named Franz Bolzer. He was a German architect, actually, and he was responsible for building a lot of the rail systems and stations over in Berlin. So he was commissioned to come out to Japan and create a design. But when he produced his design to the Japanese government, they were sort of like horrified by what he came up with. He tried to fuse Japanese traditional architecture into a massive train station building, and what he come up with something that looked like castle and shrine sort of architecture. And what the Japanese government were looking for at the time, because they were trying to modernize, they were looking for more of a Western European style building. And strangely enough, they end up turning to a Japanese architect who was passionate about Western design. His name was Tatsunu Kinko, I think, and he was responsible for building a couple of the nice train stations around Tokyo. Ultimately, some of them have been destroyed by natural disasters and so forth. But Tatsunu Kinko was the gentleman who has come up with that 330-meter long structure that we know at Tokyo Station's Marunouchi side as we know it today.
That's kind of ironic that it turned to a Japanese guy to make a Western-looking building.
Yeah, that's right, but the Western guy turned to Japanese architecture to try and come up with a solution.
Yeah. I like Tokyo Station. I think after the renovations and all that, it looks really great. That red brick facade on the front looks fantastic, especially at night when it's all lit up.
Yeah, they've really done it well there. There's over 7.5 million red bricks locally manufactured that have gone into the reconstruction of Tokyo Station back to its original specification there, and that reconstruction effort started in 2006 and finished in 2012, and I believe it cost $650 million to create. But if you ask me, I believe it's money well worth spent. It's a fascinating station.
Oh, definitely. And it looks really nice in that area. That Marunouchi area is a really nice area. I like it a lot. It's a, kind of the financial area of Tokyo. So it's a really nice area to walk around. And also, too, it's really close to the Imperial Palace for any tourists who want to go visit there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good blend and fusion of modern and historical Japan there. And ultimately, there are plenty of excellent rail connections there with multiple subway lines passing through the underground of that condensed space there.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait for them to finish all the construction they're doing at Shibuya Station. Because I don't know if you've been there recently, but that place has turned into a nightmare.
Oh, mate, it's...
They're doing so much construction there. It's just, how do you get out of this place, you know? Like, once it's all done, I suppose it'll look a lot nicer, but sure taking a long time to do whatever they're doing there.
They are, Anthony. It's I guess it's a case of a little bit of pain for a little bit of gain. Ultimately the Shibuya Station reconstruction is a 20-year effort there, and I'd say that's about 15 years into the reconstruction phase there, and it all started there in 2012 when the Hikari A building was built there, and they come up with an interesting concept there called the vertical dome there, where people can move up and down within a series of elevators and escalators, because the level from the lowest subway stations there to the highest stations there, which is ultimately the Ginza Line, is the equivalent of walking up and down an 8-story building. So you can imagine, you know, it on your knees and legs as you try and move from the lowest stations there, the Fukutoshin Line, and try and get 8 stories up to the Ginza Line above. It'd take it out of you. But yeah, there's still probably about another 5 to 7 years left of renovation work left in Shibuya Station. I guess one of the more fascinating things that'll come up and change in the next couple of years will be the increasing in space of Hachiko Square out there. That is set to increase by a factor of 1.5, in fact. So,
really? Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so ultimately, the way they're going to achieve that is the famous Scramble Crossing is basically going to become a miniature Scramble Crossing. So they're going to encroach on the road, take up several lanes of traffic, and ultimately increase the size of Hachiko Square that way. So I guess in years to come, when people return and so forth, they'll ultimately see a very different Hachiko Square, and also the department store that looks over Hachiko Square was set to be demolished in 2020, but due to the pandemic, that was delayed, and it's still on the cards to be demolished. I think it's about 12 stories, but that'll be another thing that'll change there in the next couple of years as well.
Is that the one with the Starbucks in it?
No, that's the one on the opposite side there. It's basically where the Ginza Line platforms used to be inside.
Oh, that one there. Oh, okay. Yeah, I know that one. Right. Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's the one like directly that leads directly onto the square, not across the street like that. Like
yes.
The one I'm thinking of. Yeah, that, I could see that. That's you know, I remember I did some work with JR East a long time ago. We made some bunch of videos for them. And I remember sitting in the office and they're asking me kind of what I thought about that area. And I said, I was surprised how confusing it is to get just out of Shibuya Station, considering how popular that is with tourists. When you get off, like, say, the Yamanote line, just to get to the Hachiko area, that square, it's like, how do I get out of this place? You know, like,
oh, yeah,
you can end up walking back into a department store. You're like, I don't want to be in a department store. Like, how do I get out of here? So I was quite surprised that it seemed to me like this, due to the popularity of the scramble and the square, like, it would have been better to have, like, just a clear entrance and an exit. Like, okay, you come out of the train, here you go, this is what you're looking for. I guess maybe they're going to, you know, think about that in the future, but I could definitely see improvements being made there.
Yeah, that's definitely right. There's going to be some very distinct and very clear entry and exit points there in the years to come. And these vertical urban cores that I were talking about before, there's going to be about six of them across the entire station precinct, making access to and from the station a lot more, I guess, easier and user-friendly in years to come, along with people in wheelchairs, disabled access as well. There's going to be a lot more elevators and escalators there. So it's like I said, a bit of pain for a bit of gain, but at the end of it all, it'll be well worth it when it's unveiled.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing that I really am always impressed with Japan, is that just their ability to make sure the infrastructure works so well all the time. Like, I remember, you know, whenever I went back to Thailand, and I mean, you get on the train and you get on that BTS line in Thailand and you get off at your station, and they've got like three, you know, checkout stalls there. One of them's not working, so everyone's jammed into like two.
Right.
And it just always makes me laugh, because I just thought, like, this could never happen in Japan, because the sheer number of people that they have to move, if there's any delay, if any one of those ticket machines broke down or something like that, it'd be like instantly like 10, 20,000 people like backed up. And so there's no way that you could accommodate all that. So I'm always impressed with their ability just to move large numbers of people throughout that city.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. JR East have done an exceptional job at maintaining a lot of the rail and station infrastructure there, considering that some of it is now getting on to 150 years old and it still runs like clockwork. I mean, you look at the Yamanote line, and it, before the pandemic, it used to move about 5 million passengers each day. And when you try and put that into perspective, the entire London Underground system only moves about 5 million. So here we have one single line in Tokyo moving the same amount of people as an entire metro system in London. And like, London is ultimately a benchmark for a lot of people for transportation as well. So you look at that.
Yeah, it's just the numbers are just staggering. Like, I live in Canada. Our population is about 32 million or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, like, yeah, living in Tokyo is like having the entire population of Canada in one city. It's hard for them to wrap their head around that, because Canada is so big. Our population is just spread out across the whole country. No city feels that busy.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you think about the entire population of Canada jammed into one city, that's what Tokyo's like.
Yeah, it was amazing. In 2015, I climbed Mount Fuji, and when I got to the top, I was able to look back at Tokyo 100 kilometers away, and it just blew my mind that in that space that I'm looking at, I could see with my own eyes, there was 35 million people across that entire space that I could see with my own eyes there. And like you mentioned, with Canada, Australia has a population of about 25 million, and it was just mind-blowing to me that, yeah, so many people could live and operate successfully in that one space.
Yeah. It's just, the numbers are just mind-blowing. So what do you think of the future is for the Yamanote Line? One thing I was really impressed with when I lived there is how often they changed or upgraded the train carriages. Because where I come from in Canada, they have this little, you know, line that they built like back in the 80s. They had this thing called Expo 86 here. And so they built this this rail system for that. And I honestly don't think that they've upgraded the carriages since 86, because these things are really tiny. They look out of date. I was shocked when I came back to Canada and I got on one of these. First off, there's only two carriages.
Right.
It, honestly, when you see that from a distance, it looks like a child's toy that they run up and down the train, because it's like, it's two carriages.
Right.
And I was like, you know, what is this? What is this relic? And meanwhile, in Japan, I remember I used to take the Hibiya line And I mean, it's always perfectly clean. I don't see, there's no ripped seats, there's no dirt, you know, there's no graffiti. Like, it just looks totally fine to me. And then like one day there was a brand new one.
Yeah.
Right. I thought like, what was wrong with the old one, you know? Yeah. But it's interesting how they're constantly upgrading that system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the average life of rolling stock in Japan and Tokyo especially is about 15 years. So you can expect a new generation of train carriage to be commissioned into operation every 15 years. And the Yamanote line last saw their one, which was the E235 series, enter service in 2015. So that has now been operating. And if I'm not mistaken, the entire fleet of rolling stock has been now swapped out to E235s. And they're all decked out with the latest LCD displays, displaying passenger information and advertisements. And ultimately, the future for the Yamanote line and I guess the entire rail system for Japan, they are looking to go autonomous in the years and decades ahead. JR East has communicated that they're experiencing or expecting about 25% of their workforce to retire in the next 10 years. And that equates to about 10,000 staff members. So we're talking about train operators, drivers, rail staff there, signal operators. So the operator, JR East, is looking to implement more autonomous technology. And in 2019, there was a driverless train test on the Yamanote line to try and shake out some of this new technology and try and debug it and so forth. There's still a few issues to be ironed out. In that test, there were some alignment issues. As the train pulled up to the platform, it missed the platform by several meters and so forth. But they're not expecting to implement this driverless technology for another 10 years or so. So they still have a bit of time to implement it. And more so, not just the rolling stock as well, but the stations as well are going to become less and less staffed as well. And the Takanawa Gateway Station that opened in 2020 last year is a bit of a prototype station for this level of automation. So if you get an opportunity to visit the Takanawa Gateway, you will notice that it's staffed mostly by robots. So you've got a lot of cleaning robots that are just there continuously sweeping and mopping the floor. You've got informational robots. So if you're a traveler or a tourist from any country in the world, you'll approach the information robot at the desk, and first thing you'll do is you'll select the language, and then you will ask your question in your own native language, and then the information robot is pre-programmed with a whole series of commonly asked questions, and then it will respond in your native language. That's quite mind blowing when you think about that. And there's also security robots as well. If you're in danger or you need emergency assistance, you can go up to one of these roving robots and essentially press a help point button, which gets you into contact with emergency services or other a centralized rail distribution and management center where you can, you know, make your inquiry or request emergency assistance.
Yeah, I've seen some of that route planner being implemented at some of the stations. I tried it. You can go there, you can say, hey, I want to go to this station, and it just tells you which line to take and, you know, what carriage to get on and whatnot. It even tells you, like, it's so Japanese, this what they give you, but it tells you, like, which carriage to get on to be closest to the exit when you get off at your next station, you know?
It's amazing how far it's come. I can remember the first time I went to Tokyo in 2012, and ultimately back then smartphones weren't really a thing, and it was basically had to unravel my map and my paper map and have a look, and okay, I want to go here and I've got to plant it there. And with modern technology and Google and all these information systems, it's really taken the guesswork out of it.
It's actually even more amazing if you think about the origins of it. Like, if you watch that video on your YouTube channel, to think about some of these stations literally started off as a shack on the side of the road, you know, and it was like a little loading bay for goods.
That's exactly right. I mean, the western half of the Yamanote Line was purely built for the distribution of freight. And yeah, sure, you know, 50 or so people use these train stations each day. But those train stations on the west side, and I'm talking about Shibuya and Shinjuku, those stations, they were built with haste, and ultimately they were just like slapped together with a few railway sleepers, and there you go. That was your platform there.
Could you imagine those people back then being teleported to the future and saying, hey, this is Shinjuku Station now? Like, it would just be completely mind-blowing for them to think, like, how did that shack turn into this mini city within a city?
That's right, yeah. Use exit 256 to get out.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, it is a really engineering marvel, and I'm just absolutely fascinated by it. I just love the efficiency of the train system in Tokyo, and I get frustrated whenever I visit any other large city.
Yeah, it's mind blowing, Anthony. Really, I mean, at the end of the day, when you have to move 5 million people every day successfully, you can't afford to have a jam ticket machine. Or a train breakdown. So it has to operate like a well-oiled machine. And the Yamanote Line is really the heart and the lifeblood of Tokyo as it pumps around people all across the city. And if anything happens to it during normal hours of operation, yeah, the city can get pretty log-jammed and traffic jams pretty quick.
Thanks again to Michael for coming on the show. And if you want to find out not only about the history of the Yamanote Line, but other train stations as well, check out his YouTube channel. It's called Japanese History. And I'll make sure to post a link to that in the show notes of this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. You know, the Japanese rail system, if you live there, you might take it for granted. And actually, I think the Japanese, like when they travel, they must feel like they've like literally gone back in time. Like if they go to like the New York subway or the London Underground or whatever, they must just literally think like, how do these people survive? It must be kind of like an archaeological expedition for them. But if you live in Japan, you kind of take it for granted. It's fantastic. Trust me, when you move back to North America and you have to take public transit here, good Lord, do you ever miss the rail system in Japan. Every time I take public transit, I'm not worried about getting to my destination. I'm worried about getting stabbed on the bus or something like that, or getting shot at. But yeah, definitely the rail system in Japan is amazing. And as a kind of a mini train otaku, I just love hearing about the logistics of it and how everything runs so smoothly. So yeah, check out Michael's channel. He's got a lot of other videos talking about like the different subway lines. And if you're kind of interested in that, in the train system at all, it's a fascinating look at how all of that works. So yeah, that's it. That wraps up this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsor, Jobs in Japan. If you're looking for a new job in Japan, go check them out on their website, jobsinjapan.com. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and I'll talk to you next week.